and a stinging, strong warning from a nation of nomads who lived about 3,400 years ago, stranded in the wilderness. The bad news is this. I want you to know, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same supernatural food and all drank the same supernatural drink, for they drank from the supernatural rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. The very fact that this happened is bad news. The very fact that the majority of these people who started out so good ended up so bad. But before I give you the good news and the challenging and strong warning, I want you to think about something by way of introduction. We're going to be studying in the next few weeks a series on the church. The elders have asked that I preach a series on this subject, and I'm so pleased that they've asked that I do this. But as we began this series, as we began discussing the church of the Lord in this generation, in this locale, I want us to look very briefly this morning by way of introduction to the church that existed in the wilderness back about 1400 B.C., The Bible refers to them as the church in the wilderness. It was another assembly. But there are so many similarities between us and them that I want you to see the similarities, and I want us to draw some lessons from them this morning. We'll try to keep them simple. We'll try to keep them concise. But they must be said, and I don't know of a better place to get into the study of the church than to look at a prototype that was given and recorded for our admonition. Look at the similarities, if you will, between those of us who are here today and these people who fell there in the wilderness. We have a similar background. They came out of a slave background. They had a slave mentality. They came out of a very confined, restricted circumstance. These people were in a repressive society that looked upon them as slaves and as bondmen. You young people today, as you come out of your childhood and you approach maturity, you also are coming out of a slave background. I know it doesn't quite fit. I know your mother and daddy couldn't be called Pharaoh and Mrs. Pharaoh. And I know that there are some things about it, but you take it for what it's worth. You came out of a very restricted background, one that was repressive in many ways. There were things that you were made to do and were restricted from doing that really didn't please you, but you had to do it because you were in that kind of a background. But now you've come out into total freedom. The illustration kind of breaks down here too, but nevertheless, there are going to be some times when you're going to be restricted here too, but the analogy, I think, holds true well enough that we can say that you're approaching the time when you can be a freed generation. You're being challenged to live as a free man. You're being challenged to live as an adult. And so here, your background was similar to the Israelites. They came out of a slavery and were challenged to live like free men under God. You've come out of a very closely supervised background, and now your challenge is the same. Live like free men. Live like people who are responsible before God. Now, for all of us, whether we're young or old, this is the first day in the rest of our lives. There's not a day yet that's taken place in the rest of our lives. Today's the first one. And you're being challenged, and so am I, to make this day and all the ones that remain afterwards, to make them count for the Lord. You're being asked, and I'm being asked, to live in a way that's acceptable to God. You're being asked to live up to your calling. You see, you've been called with a holy, noble calling. And it's up to us to live up to, as Paul asked the Ephesians, live up to your calling. We're being asked to live our lives in harmony with the will of God. Is that too much to ask people who have committed themselves to God? It isn't, is it? So in a very real sense, we have a similar background to these people. We also have a similar religious experience. Paul says these people were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. We've all, mostly, been baptized into Christ when we surrendered to Him as Lord and of our own free will committed ourselves to live with Him as our Master. We were buried with Him in baptism, raised with Him to walk in newness of life. So you see the similarity there. He goes on to say that these people all ate the same spiritual food and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. We have this very morning gathered around this table, a common, not in the sense of its quality, but in the sense of its universality. It's common to all of us. This table that we've gathered about, the food that we've eaten, the bread, and the wine that we've drunk, this is a similar thing that took place in our lives. So you see, we have a similar religious experience as they had. They were all baptized into Moses. We've all been baptized into Christ. They ate of the bread and they drank of the drink. We eat of this bread and we drink of this drink. And it is a continuing process throughout the rest of our lives until we cease this walk in the flesh. So you see this similarity, I say, between their situation and ours, their religious experience and ours. Now I want to ask you a question. Will their destiny be ours? Will the similarity end with our baptism and our eating the Lord's Supper? Or will we follow the example that they set of disobedience? You see, with most of them, God was not well pleased. Will He be displeased with the majority of us? I wonder what the odds are that we will be saved, or what the odds are that we'll be lost. I hope it isn't, and I'm confident that it is not, the same odds that we see pictured in their lives. Out of 603,550 male members of the Hebrew nation who left Egypt, who were over the age of 20, only two of those 603,550 got into the land of Canaan. That's Caleb and Joshua. Moses didn't make it, and those other 603,547 didn't make it. I wonder, will the similarity hold true for you and me today? Will there be that few of us that will enter the kingdom of heaven eternally? I don't think the similarity there holds true for several reasons that we'll not get into today, but I think you're aware of them. But I do want to say this before we go any further. There's a little word at the beginning of this chapter 10 that will slip by unnoticed if you're not careful, and if it slips by, then you'll miss the real impact of what Paul was saying. The word in the Greek is the word gar. It's for in the English. It's a transitional word that says, watch out for what's coming, because it illustrates what I've just said. And in the 27th verse of that 9th chapter of 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul just got through saying, I buffet my body and bring it into subjection, lest after having preached to other people, I myself should be disqualified. Who in the world said that? The Apostle Paul said it. That man who made an unquestioned, unreserved commitment to Jesus Christ says that he himself is laid open to the powers of Satan. He's laid open to the temptations of time. He's laid open to the possibility that he himself will fall. And he says, I have to buffet my body. I have to beat it black and blue. It says really, literally, in order to bring my body into subjection, lest after having spent a lifetime of preaching to other people, I myself might become rejected by God. Now he says, let me illustrate and let me show you why I say that. He says, for I don't want you to be ignorant about our fathers. They all passed through the sea. They all were under the cloud. They all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food. They all drank the same spiritual drink. You see, he said, with most of them, God was not well pleased. And then verse 12 of chapter 10 jumps up off the page literally in bold relief, when after having said that about himself, after having then illustrated it with those 603,548, he then says, therefore let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. If there's ever a warning in all the Bible that stands up and says, I demand that you listen to what I say, this warning is that stands up and says it. Listen to what he says. He says, I myself am subject to such temptations. I want to show you that the people of a former generation and of a former nation were subject to it. And he says, these things happened to them, in verse 6, by way of example, that we might not lust after evil things as they did. And there's no other way that I can say, there's no other way that he could say it any stronger than to simply say it as he said it. I'm subject to it. These people lost the race, and you stand in jeopardy of losing it yourselves. Now, standing aside and putting aside the fact of our assurance in Christ, putting aside many things, there stands this one dominant fact in the Bible that unless we are careful, we're going to be lost. I don't know how many of us are here today who will spend eternity in hell. There will be those who will go to hell from probably this very location. There'll be those who will go to hell and will spend eternity in hell because they didn't heed this warning. Now, the warning that I want to mention, that I mentioned by way of introduction, is found here because of one very clear fact. The temptations that beset that generation of the Hebrew people, that stalked them like a lion stalking its prey, and that overcame them and viciously devoured them, those same temptations are the ones that are stalking you and me right this very hour. There's not a one of us that is not subject to all of these temptations that the Apostle Paul mentions as being the downfall of the Hebrew nation. He mentions four, and I maintain that they are the ones that are today relevant, they are pertinent, and they are pressing. And unless they are given due consideration and a due and ample course of avoiding them is taken, we're going to be overtaken by these very sins that we find the Jewish people suffering from and being overturned by. What are they? Number one, idolatry. Number two, adultery and fornication. Number three, putting the Lord to the test, and we'll explain that in a moment. Number four, grumbling. These four sins are the sins that are recorded in the next few verses here. Now, these things are warnings for us not to desire evil as they desired. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put the Lord to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as a warning, but they were written down for our instruction upon whom the end of the ages has come. These four sins, I maintain, are the ones with which you right now are wrestling. I confess they're the ones with which I'm wrestling. Those of you, whether you're young or old, it just doesn't make any difference. These are the temptations and sins that are common to humanity. And I want to discuss them with you very briefly this morning. Number one, that of idolatry. This example here harks back to Exodus, the 32nd chapter, where when Moses had been up in the mount for some days now, the people were becoming discouraged. They had lost sight of a visible leader. They'd been used to following the senses of their bodies, their eyes, their ears, their smell. And so when their visible leader was taken away, they began to panic. They came with representatives to Aaron and said, look, get up and make us gods that can go before us. For as for this Moses that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So Aaron said, all right, buy your advance tickets. Give me your earrings from you, your children, your daughters, your sons. Give me all this gold, and I'll see what I can do. Then the Bible says that he put it in a fire and then took a graving tool and graved for them an animal that was resembling a calf and set it up. Then the people took over and said, this is the God that has led us out of Egypt. These are your gods, O Israel. Well, Aaron stood back up and said, now tomorrow we're going to have a feast for the Lord. We're going to make a feast to Jehovah. Aaron made an attempt here, you see, to make it under the mantle of religion. He had made an attempt to sanctify it. He had made the idol himself, but he made an attempt to compromise with the people. They were wanting these idols. Aaron knew that it wasn't right. But he made this animal as an idol and then allowed the people to compromise, and he himself compromised, in order to assuage, in order to kind of help soothe over their demands to go back into a former life. Now, I want to make one or two comments before we pass on. First of all, no amount of christening an evil practice can make it Christian. No amount of any kind of bringing it under the umbrella of Christ is going to make that which is wrong right. And I don't care how many times you say, but this is the Lord's. We're going to do this to the Lord. God had already told those people, don't you make any graven image. He had already spoken it to them. They heard it with his own voice. Yet here we find people demanding to be allowed to reincorporate things of their former life that were idolatrous and bring it in under the guise of religion and try to sanctify it and christen it as though that would make what they were doing less evil. God knew better. God said, Moses, get down there quick. These people have made an idol and they're offering sacrifices to it and they're eating and making a feast to it. Get down there. They've gone astray. You know, some of them could have said, but it was our leader that made the calf. We didn't make the calf. Our leader made it. And that's true. But you know why he made it? He made it because there was this pressure being brought upon him by the people, some 4 million people, pressuring him to allow them to bring in things with which they were acquainted in their past life. When you turn to the leadership and you say, why did you make it, Aaron? Aaron said, well, actually, all I did was put this gold in the fire, and it came out this calf, this cow. I didn't really have much to do with it, and you know, that's just what happened. Don't you believe it, Aaron? You're lying. That's not what happened. You compromised, and now you're trying to blame it on the fire or blame it on the gold. Don't blame it on anybody, Aaron. You compromised, and the people pressured you into it. Well, somebody said, well, what's the point? How does that apply to us? Just this way. We find ourselves in the same situation today. Every time we find ourselves pressured into going back and reverting to things that were in our former life. I find in our own circumstance today, I find myself asking the question, just how much of the world can we be a part of and still be Christians? Is it wrong to eat? Is it wrong to drink? Is it wrong to play? Surely these things can't be wrong, and they're not. We find these same elements present when the prodigal son returned home. His father, who represents God, made an edict that we're going to have a feast. We're going to eat, we're going to drink, we're going to play. And they began to do this. They began to dance and they began to make merry. God wasn't the instigator of that. Then is it wrong for us to do things like that? Of course not. Provided what we do doesn't carry with it the stench of the practices that we engaged in before we became Christians. People in the world eat. Sure, we're going to have to eat. People out there drink, that's right, and we have to drink too. People out there play, that's right, and we're going to play too. And it's right as long as it does not take upon itself the stench of the things that they practiced that were immoral and wrong. And yet so many times, those things that we practice as Christians, as we emerge into adulthood, we carry with us so many practices that I'm afraid have all the earmarks of worldliness. They have all the earmarks of idolatry. They have all the earmarks of the practice of the ways of the world, the way the world lives, the way the world dresses, the way the world smells, the way the world does this, the way the world entertains. We find ourselves caught in that so many times. And I'm going to mention this this morning. I'll probably not mention it again, but I'm going to mention this morning. My conscience won't let me do otherwise. I'm waiting to see what kind or what description the struggle will take. The struggle that we're going to have this year among the campus community as we wrestle with the kind of entertainment that you kids want. I'm going to sit back and watch it. It's been something every year that I've been here. Every year there's this struggle that just convulses the body. The students are clamoring for one kind of music. And listen, there's an element, and we'll notice it in just a moment. I'll reserve that comment till then. But we've got clamoring for this and clamoring for that. And you know, we come to the administration, or we come to the supervisors of the student activity and the sponsors and all, and we say, look here, bring us in some music. We've been used to all this rock music, and we want some more of it. Bring it in. So sometimes we're caught in the in the bind. And they say, well, all right, pay your advance tickets. And so sure enough, they pay the advance tickets, and here we go. And the rock music comes, and some of them, there's not any rock that's too hard or too acid to offend any of us. Sometimes we're just that unoffensive, or we're that unoffendable, and we let all this come in. And then somebody goes back then to the sponsors and say, well, why did you do this? Why did you let these things happen? And maybe they're too tended to say, well, all I did really was make an application for a rock group, and then here they come out with Grassroots. I didn't know. Grassroots happened here last year, and it was so embarrassing that it just simply took us all by surprise. And yet, why did it happen? For this simple reason. You pressure and pressure and pressure for those things that you practiced before you became Christians, really, and after you became Christians, but before you came to the age of really responsible living before God. And you find yourself craving those things and wanting to go back to them, wanting to bring them in. And I don't care how often you may sanctify it. I don't care how often you may christen it. You can call it what you will. You can bring it under the umbrella of the school. You can bring it under the auspices of the church. But it's still rank, rotten music. And if you don't believe it, stop long enough patting your foot and swaying your hips to go read the lyrics. They're the most filthy, vile, despicable that you can possibly imagine. And I'm simply saying, young people, grow up. Get out from under that sort of thing. That's exactly what these people were doing. There was a compromise going on. And Aaron got caught in the middle of it. The young people there, who I say were the young people, that generation said, look, bring us in some gods that we're used to. And I find that we're constantly surrendering our identity as the people of God because of the fact that we still want those identifiable traits of a former life to be brought in and Christianized and allowed to be practiced today. Yes, this is a very prevalent sin, that of idolatry. But there's another sin, that of immorality, fornication. This takes us back to Numbers, the 25th chapter, where when the people came into the area of Moab, their people, the men, began to play the harlot with the people of, with the women of Moab. They began to go out and bow down to their gods and eat their feasts and to partake of the fringe benefits, which always included adultery and fornication. And this was done openly and publicly. It was made known to the nation, and it brought them to tears. Moses rebuked them for it. The people came to the assembly before the door of the meeting, of the tent of meeting, and they were all weeping and crying. And they should have, because they had sinned. But lo and behold, while they were there in front of the door of the meeting, a man by the name of, what was his name? I can't think of his name right now. The woman's name, I can't think of her name either. Her name was Cosby. His name was Zimri. This man, Zimri, went over into the Midianite camp and brought this woman, Cosby, into his own camp, took him to his own father's house, and there committed adultery with her. Phinehas, one of the priests, went and took a spear and went into the tent, into their bedroom, and rammed their bodies through with one stroke, which describes pretty clearly what the position of their bodies were. He literally rammed them through in one time, killed them both. But 23,000 people died that day. How does that apply to us? Is this not a pressing sin with us today, too? Is it not that sexual immorality is a plague that continually plagues us wherever we go and we have to fight against it? It is. Do I have to tell you about the girl that insisted just recently on marrying a divorced man who was an adulterer? And the elders of this congregation says, you can't do that. Not and be a member of this congregation. You can't live like that. And she said, I'll just simply go to hell with him. I'm going to marry him. And so that stand was taken. And those who knew about it wept. And even while we were at the door of the tent of the meeting, weeping over it. Some of you are making your plans right now for your fornication. Some of you have got your plans now. You've got your targets set. I've heard plans being discussed about going to Little Rock, to the motels there, where you think you won't be detected, but you will. You don't keep things like that secret. Do I have to tell you about the girl last year who was having an extended affair with a married man of her own congregation back home? Surely you're aware that these things happen. Must I tell you about these things and name them? These people were named. Cosby and this mate of hers. And she led him into sin and it caused 23,000 people to die. Fornication, adultery will be plaguing you too. You might as well get ready for it. It's going to stalk you like a lion stalks its prey. Then there's another sin, a third one, and that's putting the Lord to the test. And I'm going to mention these two briefly, but this one deserves mention. In Numbers, the 21st chapter, the statement is made there. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient on the way. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Listen, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food. Oh. The application here is so obvious that it makes me blush. Being unthankful for food was a sin that these people committed. This worthless food. In another place it says, our strength is dried up, and there's nothing to eat, and there's nothing to even look at except this manna. And listen to the statement, it's so descriptive. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. This what's it, as Neo would tell us. What is it? Well, it's manna. That's what they called it. Let me tell you something. Before you criticize these people unduly, think about it for a moment. This is all they had for 40 solid years, manna. 40 years. This was their staple. We talk about potatoes. We talk about rice. How would you like to have this little thing that looked like a coriander seed, and that was all you had? That wasn't just part of it. That was it. Occasionally, once or twice, maybe during the time they had meat. Well, we can't even stand beans 40 days. If we go home to this same thing 40 days, what would you tell your wife? Oh, I know what you'd tell her. Look, if you can't do any better than this, get out. What's the matter? And then we look as we go through the line over here, and we see a variety of things laid out before us in royal array. And yet, because it's the same place and the same smell and the same servers, we find ourselves saying what? Two. If I have to eat that one more time, I think I'll leave school. Grumbling in the sense of putting the Lord to the test. But listen, it means more than that. I don't think the spiritual application of this can be stopped with just the revulsion against food or the rejection of it. It refers to something else. It refers to this insatiable desire for things out of the past. Just like these gods filled a need of theirs, they thought, for that which was visible that they could worship. So these people were constantly referring to what their past was before they came out of Egypt. Oh, that we don't you remember the fish and the meats of the leeks and the melons and the garlic and all this? Don't you remember that? And they'd sit around there, and their hearts went back into Egypt and lusted after those things that they had back there. And I'm confident that any time spent by Christians, when we have become children of the living God, we've been baptized into Christ, we have been the recipients of His Spirit, any time then spent lusting after things that were in our former life is the very thing that He did, or He found them doing here. And He said, you're treading on thin ice. You're tempting the Lord. And that's exactly what many times we do. James says, you adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with Christ? He says He has put this spirit in you and He's jealous over it. And then are you going to lust after things that are not even Christian? Are you not going to be content with the spiritual life and the blessings that you have in Christ? The meager fare that you may think you enjoy now or that you're subjected to now in comparison to the abundant life out in the world. I have to buffet my body now and bring it into subjection, and I don't like to do that. I have to refrain from lust, and I don't like to do that. I have to refrain from adultery and refrain from stealing and theft. Oh, you know, remember when we were out in the world, how we just had the... Be careful, he says, you're treading on thin ice. You're tempting the Lord. Well, there's a fourth and final sin, and that's grumbling. You might think that this third one would be the grumbling, but this isn't. This is not described as the grumbling. The grumbling here takes us back to the 16th chapter of Numbers, where there was a rebellion against God's authority, a rebellion against doing what God said and the way God said do it. Three men and about 250 very outstanding men of the congregation were gathered together by these three men and were brought before Moses and Aaron, and they said, just a moment, you've gone too far. God is with this whole congregation. They're all holy. Who are you to have set yourself up as the leaders of the people? And they just simply said, we're not going to submit ourselves to your authority. And they grumbled. The ground opened up and swallowed them. Fire came down out of heaven and destroyed the 250 men because of the simple fact that they refused to submit to the authority of God. One final observation. Though there are four sins mentioned here, and particularly this last one, incidentally, is one that threatens us everywhere we turn. This is the authority of God. Are we going to surrender to it and submit to it this year? If we're not, then we're wasting our time. There's no other arrangement that God has made. Just as there was no other arrangement back there but Moses and Aaron. They were the leadership. And so today, this is our leader today. This is the written word of God, and it's written for our learning, and it is for the benefit of the Christians today. There's no other guidance that we have. There's one word that occurs four times in each one of these examples, and it's the word medeh. It's the word medeh, which after following verse 6, which says, these things happened to them by way of example, and they, that we might not lust after evil things as they lusted, then it uses medeh four times, and it's translated neither. Neither be ye idolaters, neither be ye adulterers, neither put the Lord to the test, and neither grumble, which is so much to say that the real sin at stake was this lusting after evil things. It wasn't the idolatry or the adultery or the putting the Lord to the test or the grumbling. Those were the outcroppings of the lusting. And there are those of us in the audience today, and there are those in this congregation, and there always will be people who find themselves having stopped their adulteries, having stopped the grumbling, having stopped putting the Lord to the test, having stopped the idolatry visibly, but who on the inside are eaten up with the lust and the desires that never have been tamed in their Christian life. Where is your heart? Where is your heart? May I make one final observation? There was one thing that served as a key element in this whole rebellion, and that's what the Bible calls a mixed multitude. One translation calls them the rabble. They weren't Israelites. They weren't blood kin to these people. They weren't the ones with whom God had made his covenant. But they just happened along by association to be a part of the troop. And they happened by association to be under the cloud. They happened by association to be eating the food and drinking the drink. But as far as being a part of the family of God, they were not. And it says this rabble that was among them had a strong craving. And that's where much of the trouble of Israel came. You know where much of the trouble in this congregation will come? And much of the trouble wherever you find Christian people congregated? There'll be those people who are the rabble. They're the mixed multitude. They're not born again. They're not really members of the covenant of God. You know where they came into this thing? Simply by association. And many times they are the sons and daughters of elders and preachers and deacons who give the most trouble anywhere there are Christian people brought together, because there's been no conversion in their lives. They're the mixed multitude with a strong craving. And there's this insatiable, unconquerable desire that they have to always be stretching out and taking a part in the world and practicing what the world loves to practice. And they are the ones that cause the majority of the trouble and serve as the ferment and the culture in a jar of buttermilk. They serve as the culture out of which there spreads all of the foam, the fermenting, and the discontent, and the displeasing of the Lord. Will you take this warning from the wilderness or not? Millions of people will die and go to hell because they refuse to take this warning from the wilderness. Will you deal honestly with yourself? Will you come away from your lusting after evil things if you're guilty of it? Pray for me that I may also do that. Come away from idolatry. Come away from fornication. Come away from putting the Lord to the test by always looking for something that is outside the Christian's life. And then come away from grumbling about the Lord's way of doing the Lord's work. These things are challenges for us. They come out of the wilderness from a people that were stranded there nearly 3,400 years ago. What are you going to do about it? We urge you today, make your conversion genuine. If you've never been converted to Christ, then come and undergo the experience that these people here did and we have. We're all baptized into Christ. We're going to eat the table of the Lord from now on. If you've not done that, then you need to. But for the rest of us who are already here, examine your stand and see to it that you don't fail after the same falling that these people did. God was not well pleased with them. The challenge is yours. Do what you will with it, but you'll stand in the day of judgment one day to answer for it. Will you take this warning from the wilderness? May God bless you to do it while we stand and sing.